Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Dr. Julie Helmrich. I'm a psychologist here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This is Shrink and Drink Radio. We had a great time last night at Key Wisconsin in Waukesha. Had a nice crowd out there at Shrink and Drink Live. We have another Shrink and Drink this week in Wauwatosa. If you wanted to come to a live event, that's at Cranky Al's on 69th and North. Smart to call for reservations. All the information for that's on the Shrink and Drink Facebook page, so feel free to go there. We also had just a little bit of follow-on from last night, because we have decided to use the radio show to describe a few more things for people in a little bit more detail, things that were asked. There was a fair amount of discussion last night again about this, this whole idea of managing fear in relationships. And I think, one of the strategies that is most useful is, instead of seeing the differences between yourself and another person, really ramping it up and thinking at a very, maybe a higher level about what we all have in common with each other. I mean, what we have in common with each other is we've all been lonely. We all know what it feels like to have a broken heart. We all know what it's like to go after an achievement and not come in first, maybe not even place, maybe not even, be able to finish something that we start. So, we have a lot in common. We know what it's like to have a dream that we're pursuing and the loneliness of trying to keep it going when other people don't understand why it's important. We know what it's like to feel left out of something. We also know the joy of somebody treating us like we're the most important person on the planet, even if that only lasted for a moment or a second. So one of the relationship tips really is to think less about the differences that you have with another person and really bump your thinking up to a higher level and think about how, we are all one, how all of the stuff that we share, because we do share quite a bit with every other human being on the planet, and it's a lot easier to manage all relationship things if we think along those lines. Okay, we have people on the line here, so I'm going to get right to that. And we also have a written-in question that somebody posted on the Shrink and Drink Facebook page. The way to do that is under messages. You do lose some of the anonymity because, obviously, your Facebook name will show up. You will retain it with me because I don't work the Shrink and Drink page. Lisa does that. So she will get those and print them out, and I will read them and answer them on the air. So she can and does take the name off. But she will see your name. I think you should know that part. Okay, going to go to the first person here who's been waiting. And I think, can you hear me now? This is Dr. Julie Helmrich, and this is a 414 area code. And you are on the air if I click the button the correct way. Can you hear me? Your phone number ends in 16.
Oh, hello. Is that me?
That might be you. Yeah.
Hi, I'm sorry. No one told me that. I'm sorry. I didn't know I was first.
You know, we might. We don't exactly know how to do this yet. We've been at it for a couple of weeks. But we don't really know what we're doing. So, anyway, we'll figure the technology out. Okay. What can I do for you?
All right. Hi. My name is Kathleen.
Okay.
And I'm bringing up a topic that seems to be reoccurring amongst my friends. It's really not anything I'm struggling with, but one of my friends in particular is really struggling with it. And I guess it's just kind of in my forefront, and I was curious to hear what your thoughts were about it.
Good.
And that is, my friends and I are in our early to mid-50s, and a lot of our friends, a lot of my friends, I don't have any children, but a lot of my friends have their kids going through, the routine of college right now. They're dealing with empty nest, and I'm a little taken back by the amount of time my friends spend with their college-age kids all the time. And one of my friends in particular has kids that are in college that are doing very well. Everything's going fine, but she herself is really struggling. She got the idea that she thought it would be a fun time to maybe upgrade the house, even though the house they had is lovely and beautiful and fine. They upgraded and ended up selling their home very quickly. Their offer was accepted. Everything kind of moved really fast all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And while she was moving in, she completely fell apart. And I mean completely. You know, the weight loss, the anxiety, the depression. It doesn't feel like a home. My kids aren't here. Mm-hmm. And all of those sorts of things. This is a friend who's really got it going on many levels. A healthy, happy, loving marriage, close family ties. She's had a lot of death in the family. She's had siblings and both parents die over the years. I mean, it's horrendous. It's horrendous. So she's known lots of loss. So you compound that with the empty nest thing. And then, you know, I'm not sure if this, you know, moving, this idea of moving into a new home, which is lovely. It's lovely. Was just sort of another filler distraction kind of thing. But, I'm real concerned about her. But that, along with my other friends, are extremely tied to their college-age kids or kids in their 20s. And I don't think it's a bad thing. But when I look back to when we were that age, our parents were completely removed from our lives on many levels.
Right.
And I'm kind of curious about this trend. I'm worried about my friend. And so just thought I'd run it by you and see what your thoughts were.
I would be happy to share my thoughts. This is a great situation, and I don't think it's unique to your particular circle of friends.
Okay.
I'm going to sort of split this up into a number of things. First, I'm going to say that the empty nest syndrome is actually not common. And the people who have that,
oh.
So it isn't like, yeah, I know, everybody who, the typical, I know, big surprise, right? People, you know what, let me back up on that. When the psychologists were researching that, I guess I'll put it this way, they actually discovered it was a myth, with the exception of one group. And usually this was the mom, what happened was she had really, you know, her identity was mother. She really threw herself into mother, and she was a mother, and then that role was gone when the kids left. And that was the only group that actually suffered when the children left were generally moms whose entire identity, and I want to underline the word entire, because many moms, right, are very, I mean, it's, and this is great for all of us, a main part of how they think about who they are is I'm a mother. And so naturally, when she's not as much, when mothering is not as much what she has to do, you know, that's a loss. But normal route, the typical developmental route that the typical mom takes when the kids are gone, is that she gets back to her life, like stuff she put on hold, stuff she wanted to do. In fact, this becomes a little bit of a marriage stressor, because lots of times the dad is thinking like, good, the kids are gone, now she can pay more attention to me. And
sure,
it's sort of, he doesn't maybe think that consciously either, but the kids are gone, and she starts going, yay, now I get to think about me. So he's like, what? And I thought this was going to be my time. And she's like, no, it's actually my time. So that's the normal route. And often women pick up hobbies they used to have before the kids were in the picture, or hobbies that they do a little bit, they sort of throw themselves into. That's often the time that they begin to go back to school if they weren't able to finish their education, all of that kind of stuff. So the empty nest syndrome as a norm is a myth. It's not that it doesn't happen with some people, but it's a myth. Now to speak to what you're seeing with your friends who are extremely tied to their college-age kids, that is a new phenomenon, and I have the same question you have. Is that good or bad for everybody? Because I'm mid-50s too, And my parents saw me on occasion after I left college, for sure. Certainly without cell phones, without Facebook, without all of the stuff that makes it very easy and relatively inexpensive for many people to stay connected to their family of origin. You know, we just didn't. You know, we got connected to whoever we were living around. And
I think
the upside of that is there was, whether we wanted it or not, we were sort of forced into the world, and we were forced into making our way in the world. Now, if children and parents have, you know, a pretty healthy relationship, it's hard to say it would be bad for them to stay connected to each other. You know, and in fact, when I look at my own life, I moved halfway across the country to do my doctoral work, and that was a very alone time. That's a time I survived. It's not a time I would wish on anybody, though, now, even, you know, 30 years later. So would that have been easier with Facebook? Would that have been easier with cell phones? Would it have been easier even with, you know, plane tickets? They're not cheap like they used to be a few years back, but they're still affordable, right? And there's more moving around in the country, especially with that college-bound crowd. Now, I do think that part of what, and I haven't, this is just my sense, Kathleen, I haven't looked at any research, and this is purely in my own personal life, my own professional life, and just, again, sort of thinking about this as I passively, you know, look at what goes on with Facebook. I do think that people, you know, this is a new time, and there aren't any models for this. I mean, there isn't a model for, whereas my grandparents certainly could have behaved kind of the way their parents behaved, and it sort of worked. And my parents could half of their life behave the way their own parents behaved, and it sort of worked. But if I think about my 83-year-old mother, who, you know, grew up before there were lights on the front of cars, right? I mean, she had stories of lanterns on the front of cars and stories of horses, right, doing the farming. So if you think about that, she's gone from that to Skyping with my sister in Hawaii. You know, she's stretched more in her life, right, than her mother had to stretch.
Sure.
So this is a very kind of new time, and I think the connection has an upside and a downside. I think the downside is it's possible the kids care perhaps too long. This is what I wonder, I guess. Are the children, college-age children, caring for too long whether their parents approve of how they're living? You know, are they getting a strong enough sense of who they are? I usually feel like probably they are if their relationships are basically healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if, you know.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I have the same thing like, wow, my parents really did not run around thinking that their social group was going to be us. You know, they had the card club, right? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and I'm more connected to people in that next generation, right? Nieces and nephews of my brothers and sisters' children. I'm more connected to them than I was connected to my own aunts and uncles.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm a good influence, so then I think, oh, maybe that's a good thing. I don't know. So what I know for sure is we don't have a model, and this is a changing thing.
Hmm.
And I think the important thing is probably, are people healthy? Are they really healthy? So then if we take all of that and we sort of ramp it down into your friend who's really struggling, you really, I think, nailed it. I have the same, I would put it exactly the same way that you put it, that there's a sort of, she has a void, right? She has a loss. She's had all of these deaths. You know, most of us are prepared for the deaths of our parents, but the deaths of our sibling, very hard to weave that in to our lives. The first sibling to die is very hard on people in a family.
Yeah.
So she's, you know, as you said, she's got a nice marriage. She's, you know, they've you know, financially, it sounds like they have figured that out and they're doing okay.
Oh, yes.
And then you said, is this a filler or distraction, the house? Yeah, and I think if you think about someone who's had that kind of loss, like more than her fair share of loss,
mm-hmm.
usually, and if you want to discuss this with her, this is a very delicate thing to discuss, that loss
okay.
like that, that is beyond the norm, you know, wrapping our heads around that, wrapping our lives around that, invariably is a spiritual issue for people. At
mm-hmm.
some point, you know, at some point the question of, like, what kind of world am I living in anyway?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or make it more personal. What kind of a God, you know, would have this kind
yeah.
of loss, you know, be this kind of, you know, taking of people I love from me? You know, and
right.
so, you know, these are not questions that human beings have been able to avoid ever. I mean, these are century-old questions that each person in their own life has to come to some sort of terms with. What am I going to do with the fact that the world, that it is not a just world? I mean, that's not an opinion. That's a fact. There is not
mm-hmm.
justice the way
mm-hmm.
we prefer. The nice guys don't always win first. The, you know, people, many families have what I would consider more than their fair share of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a spiritual issue, right, to come to terms with that. Like, how do I get okay on some level with the unpredictability of life, with the unfairness of life, with, you know, the pain that comes just because I love somebody deeply? Or I love
right.
somebody, you know, how do I do that? These are very spiritual issues. And so when you say that she, you know, had this sort of, you know, really struggling and you know, broke
oh,
down
yeah.
with weight loss and depression and all of that, part of, and this is a very weird thing to think about, it's sort of cool, but it's also, you know, it's also difficult, I think. I had a spiritual director once who, this is when I was in my early 40s, and I thought I was moving along at a pretty nice pace, you know, in my spiritual development.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in her 70s, and I said to her something like, well, when do you think you did most of your sort of spiritual development? Hoping to hear that, you know, maybe she was done by her 40s, like maybe I'd be done.
Yeah.
And she said something to me, oh, I didn't even really start it until my mid-50s. And I, you know,
oh.
I'm like, seriously? Seriously.
Ouch.
So, yeah. So, what, you know,
yeah.
and I, with the people that I work with personally, one of the things that I see in my office is that many of these extremely difficult things for people to start looking at, I don't think we have the strength to do that until we are in our 50s. You know, the 20-somethings
well,
don't
understand. That's very interesting. Yep.
Yeah. So, sometimes I think we get the kids raised, get them into college, get them out of college, you know, downsize to the right, you know, to the right home, manage
mm-hmm.
all of this stuff, and then you're sitting there and you're sort of done, and then what comes up? The stuff you set aside for a while. You set aside,
yeah.
and, you know, maybe it takes until we're in our 50s to take on some of that stuff that's just been sitting there, you know, waiting until we had the time, waiting until we had the strength. Now, having said that, I don't want the 20-somethings and the 30-somethings who are listening to dread their 50s, because honestly, I think the 50s are great. You know, you
yeah.
don't care. You don't care about people's opinions anymore. And like, you know, nobody
yeah.
knows what a relief that is to get rid of the, you know, all of that caring about if somebody thinks you're cool or somebody thinks you're smart enough or you're rich enough or you have the cool enough car. You know, all of that stuff, you sort of go, yeah, I don't think about that stuff anymore. It's nice, you know, to be free of
yeah.
that sort of worry about social disapproval. And, you know, Oprah said that, and I went right along with her. It's like, you know what, 50 is great. Look forward to it, those of you who are in your
yeah.
30s. It's great. It's great,
yeah.
but it does mean, I think, you know, your friend might be really now facing some very, very deep and difficult spiritual questions. I talk about a book. I never know if I should recommend this book ever because it's such a powerful book, and it's a book when I was reading, I was just sobbing. So I never know if anybody should actually, well, that's right, if anybody should read this book. It's a book called The Shack.
Oh, yes. I've read it.
Yes. It's powerful.
So
and
recommend
I think
that
about,
to her. Okay.
Well, you recommend it. I'm not sure if you should. You know her, and you know the book. So
it's a
powerful book about the most horrendous kind of loss, right? And how to come to terms with that a little bit, right? How to stay engaged in life when things have been taken away from you and not resent, right, the fact that you still have to keep going on and to turn it into a good life. But he's done a very good job, I think, with the idea of what might it be like to have a conversation with God about these things. I mean, what might that look like? And it's not a, I didn't consider it a preachy book or a, you know, anything that, I don't know if that, you know, again, I think of that book on a regular basis for people who've had serious loss, but I don't, as I just said, I never know if I should actually recommend it because it's pretty moving, right? It's a very powerful book, and you don't know, you know, you don't want to open it up and then leave them hanging, right? That's why I don't know. But I think, you know, it will make a difference for people to just be with her while she's doing this. You don't have to, I mean, it makes a difference to be with somebody while they're grieving and while they're trying to figure out what's chapter next going to look like here for me.
Uh-huh.
And she's has some sort of indication that that's happening, that the kids are kind of whatever. You know, they're sort of moving on. They're getting their lives together. They've found somebody that they might spend their life with. They're figuring out their careers. You know, they're looking forward. They're not looking too like, I need to, you know, have mom be my best friend still. You know, they're not. They're thinking about my husband's going to be my best friend or, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So it's major transition time.
It is. This was really helpful. Thank you.
Okay. Well, good. You're very
really
welcome.
Helpful.
I'm glad you called in.
Thank you.
If you decide to suggest a shack to her and she does read it down the road, I'd really love hearing from you again to let me know how that turned out for her, if it actually helped her or if it's a bad idea for me to ever recommend that book to anybody. All right.
All right.
Well, thank you, Kathleen, for calling in. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Do we have a written-in question? So I'm going to take that one next. I'm just going to read it now. I have a really hard time getting things finished. I start a project and move on to the next one before completing the last one. For example, I will start painting and have to wait for the paint to dry, so I will move on to gardening and do that until dinner or whatever. Then I move on to something else, but not my painting. What is wrong? How do I finish a project? I don't know. You might be a mom. Moms do this all the time, where they go from one thing to another thing to another thing. I don't think that's actually psychological. I get why mothers do that, and I get why homemakers do that, and I get why people who run businesses, especially if it's a small business where there are, I don't know, 2, 3, 5 employees, and it's a lot about self-employment, and there's not a lot of extra, you know, profit left over, so you can just hire people to work in the business while you work on the business. So I think people who are really busy do this a lot. It doesn't, here's the research, though, on moving around on projects like that. At some point, you have to assess whether this is going on or not. If this is not going on, don't worry about it. If what is going on is that you get to a point and then you're just like, I don't really like that very well, so then you're quitting out of a kind of, let's see, you've reached a hard spot and you're just quitting, and now you're going on to something else that's easy, and when you reach a hard spot there, you just quit. And then you go on to the next thing, and when you reach a hard spot, you just quit. If you do that, that's a problem. And the problem is that your psyche is getting weaker and weaker and weaker. It's not actually getting stronger and tougher and able to handle more and more problems and able to be more, let's see, I'm just going to say more skilled in problem solving. Let's just put it that way. So you have to assess that. If what you're doing is taking breaks from one hard thing and you take a break at an appropriate time and you take on something else and you're taking a break at an appropriate time and eventually you come back to finishing it, it's actually no problem. But I guess I'll take it this way, that if you were actually finishing things, you probably wouldn't have written in the question. So the trick is to actually, I think, again, we talked about this very early on, I think one of the best psychological strategies, and David Allen, I don't think, meant to do it as a really good psychological strategy, but it actually is. He wrote a book a number of years ago called Getting Things Done, and the genius part of the system is for you to take every single thing related to a particular project and write it down and figure out what the actual next action is. And then usually next actions are very short. Usually they take a minute, 3 minutes, 15 minutes. A next action does not take all day. If you write down the next thing that I need to do to get the painting finished, it's probably going to be something like, I need a better brush. Okay, so the next action is actually to go to the garage and get a better brush. Or the next action might be go to Home Depot and get a better brush. Or the next action might be, that you really do just simply have to set that aside because the paint is drying. Your next action is to go get some, Saran wrap or something like that to cover your paint pan, so that it doesn't dry out. So people who get a lot of things done and finished, they may actually get it finished perfectly, but one of the things that David Allen says in his book, which I really like, is he said, you call a project finished when it's finished enough. I mean, in other words, if you clean your garage, something as simple as that, I mean, you could walk into anybody's garage, including somebody's garage who just cleaned their garage, and I could usually find another thing or two that they could do to get the garage cleaned. But they, it's good. When it's enough, when it's close enough to what you had in mind when you said, I need to clean the garage, that's when you call it done. So his system is less about getting everything done, and it's more about moving every single project forward until it's done enough. And I think that's a much better way to think about finishing. I am moving this project forward enough until it's done enough. That takes it out of perfection mode. And one of the interesting things about perfectionists is they often don't finish things because they're actually going for perfection. And guess what happens? You just can't ever get anything perfect. So they have the wrong destination. The destination is perfection. And actually the thing to do is to move things forward. Now, what I like about this question is that, I start painting and then I move to gardening, and then I move to dinner, and then I'll move on to something else, but not back to my painting. I would highly recommend that, besides getting David Allen's book and reading it and using it, I would highly recommend that you really keep a limit on the number of projects that you start. If you're going to start, that was just three, including, dinner's going to be finished enough as soon as people eat it and the dishes are done, right? So, if you take that off the list and you think about something like painting and gardening, which, I mean, I don't know a single gardener who doesn't have another gardening project that they have that they're working on. There's always something to do when you're working with plants. So think about probably no more than two or three projects in a day that you're trying to move forward, if what you know is that you move from one to another, because then you will eventually move back to one of your three projects in that day, and just think in terms of getting it done. Now, here's another thing, or moving it forward. Here's another thing that people who are not sort of progress focused. I talked in an earlier radio a show about the progress principle, which is the number one motivator for people is making progress. You're probably keeping yourself motivated by making some progress, and then when it gets a little difficult, you probably stop and you go on to something else that you can make a little bit of progress on. You probably want to use some kind of a marker of any kind you want. It could be, you know, counting the square inches you've got painted, or the number of walls you've finished painting, or something like that, or counting, you know, the square footage that you have weeded, so that you can really see how close you are to being done with some portion of that project. Because people, I've said this probably now, not 100 times, but many, many times on this radio show, we have to measure if we want to make our lives good. We have to measure something, because otherwise we just can't keep going. I mean, think about it. If you were in a car for 4 hours and you couldn't tell, you know, had you driven from Milwaukee to Iowa or not, if you can't tell that you're going anywhere, it's very hard to just sit in a car and act like you're driving for 4 hours. We can't do it. On the other hand, many, many people, especially people like me who are okay driving, we could drive from one end of the country to the other end of the country, and what keeps you going is that the scenery keeps changing, and that gives you a feeling of progress. So we really do need to have a feeling of progress. It's very difficult to get going if we don't have a sense that we're moving somewhere. Now, this questioner, the person who's asking this question, is basically not going back to projects, but there's going to have to be sort of a limiting of that, and you may really need to just measure that you are making more and more progress towards the particular project and stay focused. There's one thing that people believe works really well, which is multitasking, and multitaskers are a big fan of that, but the research does not support that, folks. The research says people who focus on one project and move it as far as they possibly can until they are stopped by something external to them, like, I need more paint, that those are the people who are the happiest and they get the most done. So multitasking out and focus in, folks. That's what the research is saying. So probably don't send me any hate mail, you multitaskers. I know you love doing your life that way. But the research says, guess what? You're not getting as much done as you might get done, nor are you as happy as you might be if you can just keep yourself focused until you mostly get a project done. Okay, I just looked at the time. We are at the end of our time. And as always, we really appreciate that people are, besides calling in, listening in. I'm honestly quite shocked at the number of listens that we've had so far. We thought we might get a few hundred after a month or so, and here we are in the middle of week three. I think this is week three, and we're approaching 2,000 listens, so that's cool. If you are in town, as I said before, come on over to Cranky Owls in Wauwatosa, 69th and North, and join us for Shrink and Drink Live tomorrow night. That's September 20th. I get there at 7. You should get there at 6:30 and get one of their world-famous pizzas ordered up, and say hi to Joey, Alex, and Susie. All right. If you have a Facebook page, appreciate it if you go over to the Shrink and Drink page and click on like. And if you can find your way to Blog Talk Radio, I believe there is a way to do a Facebook like also there. All right. Thank you, everyone, for calling in. Have a good rest of your day.